Hi, Sue Hall and Tristan McDonald here with our fourth podcast in our third series, focusing on the gift that we all share. This gift is described in detail in podcast number 3.1. Today, we have Julie Salisbury with us, all the way from lovely warm Mexico. Julie is the founder of Influence Publishing, and we met at one of her Learn to Write a Book workshops. So she is Fish Don't Climb Trees doula. So welcome, Julie. Lovely to see you.
Thank you, Sue, and wonderful to see you. I think it's probably been a few years since we saw each other.
Just a few, like about seven, maybe. Oh, dear. Now let's get straight into it. You discovered that you have the gifts of dyslexia, but do you remember when that was? Was it during that workshop?
It was, yes. I actually remember it very clearly, Sue, because it was you that told me that you thought I was dyslexic. And I can remember when you said that, looking at you and going, Sue, that is really not good for business. I'm a book publisher. And that was the start of it. And then you said to me, well, do you have dyslexia in the family? And I said, no, not that I know of. And you said, are you sure? And I said, well, I've never asked the question. And so then I rang my mum and I asked my mum and she said, oh, well, don't tell your dad that I told you this. But when I married your dad, he couldn't read or write.
Oh, my gosh.
And he had a really bad time at school, but they didn't know what was wrong. And so he just thought he was dumb or stupid or slow or something. And of course, my dad was really frightened that his children would also have to go through the same. And so he told my mom, please never tell the children that I can't read or write. Oh. And so it was kept as a family secret. And then eventually, I guess, because I told her that I was going to be doing a TED talk, she realized that she needed to tell dad that she had actually told me. And so I then rang dad and he told me all about it. He told me about how he had such a terrible time at school, that he had to sit in the corner of the class and wear a dunce hat. And of course, in those days, they didn't understand dyslexia at all. And he's 84 now, right? To give you a context of age. And, you know, he just had a very bad time. He was caned all the time, like across the hands for being lazy.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, he had a very difficult time. And it wasn't until he went into management in his job. He worked for the Holiday Inn. And he was a maintenance engineer. So, of course, he was putting his sort of creative and problem-solving skills to work. Yeah. But then he went into management and he had to go onto a management training course where, of course, he had to be able to read and write. And it was then, I mean, and he must have been, I'm guessing, late, maybe 30 or 40, something like that. And then he actually saw an advert on the TV about dyslexia. This was in England. And he rang the number and then he had learned to read and write much later in life.
Oh my gosh, good for him.
When he was working as an engineer, how did he cope when working in that environment and have nobody notice that he couldn't do those two things?
He told me some of the tricks that he used to do. Like, for example, he would memorize words that he needed to use for his job. He would do things like see words in the newspaper and then copy them. So he was very, very, very resourceful to keep it a secret. When he went on the management training course, he pretended to be ill so that he didn't do the test and lots of different things to avoid it. But eventually he did have to tell them that he couldn't read and write. And apparently they were all very nice and helpful about it. And they allowed him to do sort of audio learning and things like that. And then, of course, he did actually learn to read and write later in life. Yeah, like it was interesting because it really brought us close together because he had never talked to anybody about it. Our mum was the only one that knew. And so it was kept a real dark family secret. Yeah. And even now, he doesn't want my sisters or anybody else to know. So even though he's talked to me about it, and I've assured him, you know, Dad, don't think of it as a disability and look what you've done with life and it's amazing. And look, you know, I'm a book publisher and it hasn't stopped me. But even with that, he still has shame around it and he doesn't want to tell my other two sisters.
Oh, my. So that leads us into your creativity and your problem solving skills.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because I did have a hard time at school. And I always put it down to that I was slow or that I didn't learn as fast as other people. I was one of those people that I struggled to get D's. And my friends were getting A's and B's and they didn't even have to do anything. You know, they would just like cram study the night before an exam. And they would say to me, well, why is it taking you so long? And what's your problem sort of thing? But my mom and dad always encouraged me. And they always said, oh, don't worry, you just have to study harder. And I had extra lessons from teachers. And I always remember working, doing homework every single night, whereas my friends were not doing that. And the strange thing is that I actually excelled in English literature. That was the one topic that I really, really excelled. It was the only topic that I actually got a B in my exam. And that was because literature in itself, the exam was all about interpreting the story. And so you were permitted to be creative. And so that's why I excelled in that. And then I guess I realized that creative things was what I was drawn to. So I ended up in marketing, actually in product development. So I was actually creating products. It was very hands-on and very sort of creative. And I didn't realize until I actually wrote my own book that I was applying exactly the same process to bringing bath products to the market. I was applying the same system to writing my book. And I didn't realize, I thought everybody did it that way. Like I had no idea that I was creating this new process or way of approaching writing a book. And I just thought that that was normal and everybody does that. But then I realized I started to help other people. And that was just, you know, in my circles, that would have been back, well, almost 15 years ago now. And people were saying, so what did you do to write your book? And I realized that the way I was telling them to do it really worked for them. And so then I started doing community classes and I started getting more and more feedback that this is great and this is really helpful. And that's when I started Influence Publishing in 2010, because I had so many people telling me how great it was that I was helping people write books. There was a big demand. So it was just something that I realized I needed to do. And so I created what I like to think of as a new paradigm in publishing, you know, different from self-publishing, different from traditional publishing. And of course, that's also something that I think dyslexics do a lot. When we think of Steve Jobs and some of those more creative people, they do problem solving, right? And that's what I basically did to the publishing industry. I created a new paradigm. I created a new way of approaching writing and publishing books. And I didn't even realize that I was using the gift to do what I did until you told me, Sue.
Well, and you know, the thing that stands out for me with that 2-day workshop, I remember that you gave us all great big pieces of paper and you stuck them on the walls and you gave us all felt tips and you said, now map out what your book is going to be about. So I'm in heaven, right? I've got the felt tips, I've got the bubbles, I've got little drawings in all my bubbles, right? And I'm done in about 10 minutes. And I turn around and I look at everybody else bubbles and they've all got words in them. Why would you do that? Or what the story's about, you've got to read the bubble.
That's such an interesting way of brainstorming your book from start to finish. That's really, really cool.
And that's exactly how I approached bringing a product to market, right? So you work backwards. So you say, what is it that the consumer wants? And then you create what the consumer wants. And that is basically the approach I took to books, is to say, well, who are you going to help with your story? And what do they want to know? And how can they get that information out in a way that actually helps the consumer, the reader? And so the mind mapping, I didn't realize at the time, Sue, when you pointed it out to me, that was my way of teaching, because I realized, just like you, Sue, that this was fun and yay, I can do this. And so I was basically showing other people a different way to learn. I was just adapting to a process that I found easy. And then I was using that to help other people. And just like Sue, she said, wow, you know, I can do this, I can do this. And everybody else did the same. And so it's kind of interesting, because what I've done is completely approached how to write a book in a totally different way, new paradigm, out of the box. And that's what works. And it really works for everybody. And as far as I know, nobody else does it.
That's fantastic. I remember when my son was at school and he was having to learn how to write essays. He kept saying to me, Mommy says, why do they need the beginning and the middle and the end? He says, I know what the end is. All I have to do is get to the end. and that's what you're saying, really, isn't it?
That's totally what I'm saying. I say that even with the writing process, I encourage people to start at the end. So I encourage people to actually start writing their book at the end. And the introduction is one of the very last things that you do, because how can you introduce a book when you haven't even read it? To me, it's logical. It's like, why would you write an introduction first? You don't know what you're introducing because you haven't written it yet.
Totally. Oh, I think that's so fun. It really is. This gift, this whole ability to alter perception and see things from different angles. And, you know, we see the big picture. Looking back now, where do you feel that you started to use that? Yes, you learned marketing and then you probably used it then, but did you use it when you were sailing around the world?
I don't know about that, because I think that if anything, when I was sailing around the world, what I realized was that it was a very difficult thing for me to learn. And I didn't understand at the time why it was so difficult. But like I said, I just thought to myself, well, it's because I'm not good at learning things. But I realize now that the reason I found it so difficult was because everything is reversed, right? When you're driving a dinghy, if you want it to go right, then you have to take the propeller and move it left. Everything is reversed, which is just a total mind bend for a dyslexic person, right? Challenging anyway with left and right and coordination. Well, now I mean, to that almost challenge. It's just interesting, Sue, because one of the other things is how the memory piece really impacts different people. I know that people with dyslexia have different memory challenges, but for me, I feel like I have big blanks in my life. And that's often people giving me feedback as opposed to me thinking about it. Like I've driven to somebody's house 20 times and I still have no idea how to get there.
I know. But there's a whole piece in there about direction, like left and right and having a sense of direction. Some dyslexics have an amazing sense of direction. Mm. They can find themselves anywhere. They never get lost. Me, if I take a few wrong turnings, I lost Costco the other day. I know where Costco is, but I just couldn't get there because they said north or south on the road. And I thought, but it's west, that type of thing.
Yes.
If I'm turned around enough, then forget it. I just have to go home.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It's just not going to work.
Same for me.
But I have one client who's a pilot for bringing boats into the harbour, an amazing sense of direction.
That piece is still a mystery to me, because, and I know that when I did my TED talk, those two pieces were the pieces that I probably had the most feedback from, because there were a lot of dyslexic people that said, well, I don't have a problem with my sense of direction, or I don't have a problem with my coordination or whatever, right? If you look at my TED talk, it's had almost 85,000 hits now, which is really fantastic. I'm really happy with that.
The fact that there can be both ends of a spectrum is interesting. So going back to the memory thing, I often think to myself, because I think in pictures, I need a picture to think with, obviously.
Yes.
Right? And so if I don't have a picture for a certain word, it's not going to make an impact. But at the same time, sometimes I think I've got the general picture, but I haven't actually fixed it. It's almost like you get a picture that sort of wafts through your head, right? But unless you actually stick it in the photo album. So when it comes to direction for me and memory and stuff like that, if I park at the airport, for example, and I walk into the building, you'd think that I'd be able to walk back again and find the car, right? But no.
No, me neither.
What I have to do is I have to turn round at the first place where I need a choice. I have to take a picture and I actually have to fix that picture in my head. And
me
then
too.
I can keep walking and then I can turn around and fix that picture. But it's the fixing part that makes the difference.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you will have some of my kids who can find anything. Like when their parents say, where did I leave that? They'll know exactly where it is. I'll have an electrician who's on site and the people will say, we've lost something. Or they say, oh, it's over there. And I don't know if they fix every picture. Do you know what I mean? It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm really terrible with street names, but I can remember the look of the road, the look of the street, and landmarks. Someone says, oh, tell me where Rupert Street is. I'm like, I have no clue.
Yes. Well, going back to the traveling part, Sue, I did a lot of travel by myself. So when I got off the boat, I actually did a lot of backpacking in Asia. I went through Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, a lot of traveling all by myself. And I was always terrified of finding my hotel. If I'm going to go out for the day, how am I possibly going to find my way back, right? And so I would actually do exactly as Tristan just described. I would have a picture of the hotel, where it was. Mm. And just like you said, Sue, I'd have to turn around and I'd have to in my mind in terms of this is the road I'm looking for, or these are the landmarks. Yeah, I mean, maybe there's some people that just automatically do that and they're able to process it faster. And that's why they never feel like they get lost. That brings me actually to dancing, because I think that I've always loved dancing, but the traditional English or Western style dancing is a simple beat, boom, 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 boom. But I've always been totally fascinated by dancing, which involves routine or fancy steps. And so, as you know, I am now in Mexico and my partner is a salsa instructor. Yes. And so he has managed to teach me how to salsa dance, which is actually a very complicated dance because it has seven steps, and the seven steps are sort of like out of a normal beat that they're used to hearing. Mm-hmm. I had to tell him, you're never going to teach me this dance because I cannot get the step. It's too difficult. It's left and right coordination. It's never going to work for me. And he tried everything, and I explained to him about dyslexia, and he was like, oh, okay, well, now I know what to do. And he actually used props to help me to learn how to dance. So one of the things he did was he used my shoes, and he would put my shoes in the direction that my feet were supposed to be going so that I could look at my own shoes and then know where my feet were supposed to be. So
I love it. That's amazing.
And it wasn't until I memorized those steps and could do them naturally before I could dance to music. So it was like this kind of reverse process again, where I was like, I couldn't dance to music. I couldn't have my steps in time with the music. So I had to work backwards and learn the steps, and then I could listen to music and put the steps with the music.
That's fantastic. One thing at a time.
Yes, exactly.
I love it. That reminds me of one of the ladies that I used to work with is incredibly dyslexic, and she wanted to learn flamenco. So she cut out footprints and she had to follow the footprints on the door. That's just reminded me.
I think the overall message I'm getting in this conversation is that we just have to figure out the best way to learn for us. And visually is a big part of that. So I think if you're aware of it, then it actually makes things easier. And I'm so happy I'm having this conversation, because I realize with my Spanish teacher, I mean, I've been trying to learn Spanish for 2 years, and I live with a Mexican. I have the TV on constantly in Spanish, and I have people around me constantly talking Spanish, and I still can't speak Spanish, right? And I interview several teachers and explain to them that we're going to have to figure out how I can learn the language, because I know that we cannot learn this the traditional way that you want to teach me. And so my Spanish teacher has tried everything to help me, and she's so wonderfully, amazingly patient. But I think I'm going to have to go back to just pure pictures, because that's what worked the best for me.
Well, now we need to have a Zoom session, because you know a little bit of what we do. It would be fun to see if that worked. If you made a little clay cat, for example, and then you had the Spanish for cat that you make the word in plasticine clay as well, and see if that works.
I'll get there eventually.
Okay. And this is the fun part about going back to that duality, where you have a certain element of your dyslexia and it can work against you sometimes and it can work for you sometimes. And some people have perfect pitch and some people can't sing a note and some people can't catch to save their lives and some are incredible athletes. That's the bit I don't quite understand. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we have the gift, we have this ability to auto perception, but whoever we are, it sort of comes through in a different fashion, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely seems to be that way. And one of the things about my TED talk, when I talk about how my dad kept this from me, I am always curious that if I had known that I was dyslexic, would I have ever become a book publisher? Mm-hmm. And I actually think if I look back on that question, and be very honest with myself, I think I would say no, I wouldn't have been a book publisher. And also, I think I would not have written a book, because I think I would have had prejudgment and a perception about what that was. And then I think I would have felt always that I was defending myself. Whereas the way I have done it, it's been a very positive experience, because I'm able to use the fact that I'm a dyslexic book publisher to help people. Because most people, I would say almost without exception, don't think that their story is interesting enough, or they don't know how to write the story, or they don't know how to approach it, or they don't think they're good enough. And so when I tell them that I'm a dyslexic book publisher, it makes them feel safer. They're like, oh, well, if she can do it, then perhaps, right? And it's interesting that because I didn't know I was dyslexic before I became a book publisher, I was able to prove my success and prove how good I was at my job. And then because I had that level of confidence, because I had been doing that for at least 5 years, 6 years before you and I met, Sue, I had that level of confidence to be able to say, hey, I am a dyslexic publisher, and you better believe that that's a gift, because that's definitely something that has helped me to help you. I always feel that that's an interesting question that I would ask myself. And I know that it's a subject that many people on the TED channel were very upset that I had said that it could be an advantage not to know that you're dyslexic. But yeah, I just think it's an interesting question.
If people learn how to change gears and look at it in a much more positive manner, people can tell their children, yes, you are dyslexic, and it's perfectly fine.
Yes, exactly.
It's the head patting that gets me when they say, oh, you know what? That's okay. We'll find something you're good at. That is just so patronizing.
That is.
I'm sure they feel they're being kind, but they need to understand that we're not succeeding in spite of our dyslexia. We're succeeding because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's such a good point, Sue, that we're succeeding because of it. And I think for parents, I'm not a parent, but I think of my authors as children, because that's how I think of my family of writers, think of them like a family. I think that if I was a parent, I think what I would be doing is telling my child that they think differently and that they have to look at the best way to actually use that way of thinking as a gift, and that you have abilities, superpowers that other children don't have. And rather than talking about it as a disability, because people still call it a disability, right?
I know.
That's the wrong word to start with.
Absolutely. This is beautiful, because we've sort of come back to the beginning in a way, discussing the stigma that your father had and knowing that it's not necessary to feel that anymore. But it's information that's going to make it change, because unless people know there's a problem, they're not going to want to do something about it. And part of our podcast series is to get that information out there. So,
and I'd love to change the language from a problem as opposed to an opportunity. It's an opportunity to think about the best way that we can all learn. And that's really what I'm doing, trying to learn Spanish, is that I'm consciously aware that I learn in a different way. So I'm consciously trying to figure out the best way to learn. So I'm thinking about that all the time. And I am making people around me that I don't learn in the same way that other people learn. It takes a little bit of courage to do that, to actually step forward and say, look, I learn in a different way. So you're going to need to adapt the way that you teach. Otherwise, we're not going to have a successful relationship.
Amen.
Well, that is just perfect.
So many people want to learn in different ways. And I think what I'm doing is proof of that, right? Because I am showing that of all the people that I teach how to write a book, all of them, without exception, find this an easier way to write a book. So it doesn't seem to matter like how they want to learn. Using these different tools is a better way of learning.
Just one practical question. You obviously have to read their scripts.
Yes.
Are you okay with that part?
I'm very slow, which again, I've seen as an advantage. Because I'm very slow, I have to take a lot of time time with their manuscript. So I'm not somebody that can just skim the words and get an idea. I actually have to spend a lot of time with every manuscript. Now, that, of course, is a benefit to the writer because I'm really spending a lot of detailed time. Again, I see that as an advantage, although I'm very mindful that I probably spend at least double, if not triple, the amount of time on a manuscript that a normal publisher would spend on a manuscript.
That is an advantage for sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes, because absolutely.
I can't imagine having to read manuscript after manuscript. I would tend to do the skipping thing. So I would be grateful for somebody who didn't.
Yeah. And it's better for me to take it in bite-sized pieces. So that's how I teach. So for now, I have a teaching method. I've really perfected it, Sue. And I do weekly coaching with people so that they can actually give me the writing as they go along. So then instead of me reviewing whole manuscripts, I'm reviewing basically a chapter at a time, or basically the writing that they've done that week. And then by the time I've got a full manuscript, a full first draft, so to speak, then I can pass it to an editor. And then it's the editor that does the technical editing. So I'm really focusing a lot more on the development. So it's the development of the story, the development and the flow and the structure of the story and the purpose of the story, as opposed to what I call the technical side of the story. Yeah.
I had my first draft and I sent it to a friend who was an English teacher. I thought my grammar was pretty okay, actually. The whole manuscript came back covered in red ink.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I don't even pretend to have grammar as an expertise, but, you know, I have a team of editors and that's what their specialty is. And, you know, that's the other thing I point out to people. It's if you really professionally want to publish a book and you think that you can do this all yourself, which is what a lot of people do nowadays because self-publishing is available to a lot of people, that's just fine. But realize that you don't have the skill set to do that all yourself. So if you want to do it all yourself, what you need to do is find a professional editor, a professional proofreader, a professional structural editor, a professional typesetter, a professional designer. You know, you're not really doing it yourself. You need a team of people with those specialty areas. People need to understand that a good book is about a good story, but the actual writing and production of it takes a team of people.
Is there anything that you would like to leave our listeners with about this wonderful gift that you have? And I think you're saying you're glad that you have this gift.
I am definitely glad that I have the gift. And I believe that if more people could look at the way that their mind works and what they can do with it to be creative and to be resourceful and to look at different ways that you can approach life, then I think that the world would be a much better place because there would be a lot more creative people solving the problems world. The world's problems. There you go. There's classic dyslexia. Just thought I'd throw that in so you know I'm not perfect. But I did want to let everybody know, Sue, that I am working on a book about dyslexia. I want a book of inspiring stories. So I'm actually looking for people that have recognized their gift of dyslexia and they have become very successful in life as a result of their gift. And so for any of your listeners that are listening to this, if you feel like you have an inspiring story, then I'd love to hear from you because I'm looking for maybe 10 to 20 stories to come together in one book. It's probably going to be called The Flip Side of Dyslexia because I actually want to create almost a brand around that so that people can actually look at dyslexia in a different way. So if that's something that you think that you would be interested in, you know, please get in contact with me. And I'm sure my contact information is going to be on this podcast somewhere, Sue, right?
And I don't think you could have summed it up any better. I'm so grateful for you being with us.
You too, Sue.
Well, that was a treat. Thank you, Julie, very, very much. I find it funny how everything that we do in our lives seems to culminate in exactly what we're meant to be doing. And Julie is a very fine example of that. So if you'd like to get hold of her, you can email her at founder founder at influencepublishing.com. And Julie has very kindly offered a $500 Canadian discount to anyone who would like to get in touch with her about writing a book or about being part of this collective book, if you have listened to this podcast and found her through this channel. So that's a wonderfully generous offer. And I hope that some of you will be able to take that up. I think that brings us to Christmas Eve, and we are going to take a little break, and hopefully we will have some more podcasts for you in 2021. We wish you the very happiest of holidays that you could possibly have in this very strange time, and we look forward to having you join us in the new year. Take care, stay safe, be healthy. Happy 2021.